ओम आरभ्यते जीव जगत् परात्मा आरभ्यते जीव जगत् परात्मा तत्त्वाभिधानेन मतं समस्तम् तत्त्वाभिधानेन मतं समस्तम् इदं त्रयं यावत् अहं मति स्यात् सर्वोत्तमाहं मतिशून्यनिष्ठा आरभ्यते जीव जगत् परमात्मा तत्त्व अभिधानेन. That whole thing is a compound. Jiva, jagat, paratma, tattva, abhidhanena. Matam, samastam, idam, trayam, yavat, ahammati, syat. Sarva, uttama, aham, mati, ahammati, shunya, nishtha. Says so end of the first line, matam samastam. Matam samastam. A mat, like maybe the people in India have heard that, like the Shankara mat, or the, actually this is a different, this mat comes from the root man. It's a little bit different than the Shankara mat. The root man means to think. And so a matta means like a belief or a doctrine or a philosophical system is in India called a mat, a matta. It's where some philosophical conclusions where a group of people have a certain siddhanta. Siddhanta means what is their established belief system about the nature of reality. So here in the Bhasha, here it says shastriyaha siddhantaha. He says all of these siddhantas, all of these philosophical systems, which are shastric, means they're all kind of included within the Vedic society. Or within the Vedic culture, they're all shastric. He says such philosophical systems, for instance, as Dvaita. The Dvaita means are the dualists. And you could say the Dvaitas or the Vaisheshikas, the Yogis, the Bauddha, the Buddhists, the Sikhs. These are all philosophical systems. I mean, there'll be smaller groups that have their own philosophical systems. So what he's saying is, whatever the metta may be, whatever the philosophical system, whatever the belief set will be, and it's a belief set, means a religious belief set, which accepts the existence of God. That's basically what it is. Because in the context of Vedic society, that accept the Vedas as a means of knowledge, there's always a God concept. So here he says, within that group of people that accepts the Vedas as a pramana, as a means of knowledge, matam samastam, all of those mats, beginning with whether they be Dvaitins or Advaitins, Danya, you can't get on either. There's a lot of people, and I'll try one more thing, but that half of the people can't hear at all, so I tried using a PC. But I've been working with this for a long time. I'll do one more thing, and then we just have to let it go.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, I know. Okay, so you're the caller. That's okay. Bye. Oh, my gosh, I got to get this thing together. It's just one of the darshanas.
Yeah.
Sorry about this, everybody. I just don't like all those people not to be able to hear. It doesn't look very good.
Vaisheshika means monster.
Mm-hmm. All of them.
Sankhya, yoga.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, like that. So he's covering it.
Okay, everybody, this is it. Testing, testing. I see nothing. What a shame. Testing, testing. Oh. Okay. How's that? Testing. Okay, this is the end. Okay, good. For some of you it works. I think for the Mac people it's not working. Here we go. So samastam matam. All mutts arabhyate. All of them begin with this is pure. This is so much Ramana. He says, all of the mutts, all of them begin with, they begin, arabhyate, by abhidana, by naming the jagat, the jiva, the jagat, the jiva, the jagat, and paramatma. The jiva is the individual. First, if we're looking at this whole creation, first thing, here I am. The jiva, the I. Then there's the jagat, everything that I perceive. Then there's Paramatma. Paramatma here just means Ishwara. There's the Lord, the one who is the creator, the one who I can't see. The jagat I can see, I can perceive as idam. So here's the aham, I, and here's the idam, this. So everything that's within my range of perception, that is the jagat, the universe. I mean, I may need a microscope or a telescope, or I may have to travel, but I can perceive it. So whatever is perceivable, you know, whichever I'm able to perceive, that's the jagat, that's the universe. So aham, I, idam, this, and then the nature of Ishwara, the nature of the Lord. So he says, every mutt begins with this, a description of, a naming of the jiva, the universe, the jagat, and Ishwara, and the Lord. In the Bhasha, he says, that's true, all of the muttas begin there, including Advaita Vedanta, non-dual. It will begin there. But the difference is with Advaita is that it doesn't end there. It doesn't end there because Advaita means non-dual. That means the subject and the object have to resolve into one, right? The I and the you, or the I and the this, if there's Advaita, has to resolve into one being. But the others, unless they're Advaita, they will not resolve into one being, right? Because they're not non-dual. So here he says, all muttas begin with this, jiva, jagat, and Ishwara, by naming the jiva, jagat, and Ishwara. He said, idam trayam, this group of three, idam means this traya, these three, idam trayam, this group of three, yavat, is there as long as, yavat means as long as, these three are there as long as the ahammati is there. Ahammati is the same meaning as ahankara. Sometimes you'll hear it as ahambuddhi. So ahammati means the conviction of the I, the conclusion of the I. The ahankara, which is more of a normal term that's being used more commonly, is literally means the making an I which is created. It's a created I. So for us, for any jiva, what we mean exactly by the ahankara is each one of us will say, I am, I am, I am, I exist, I am a conscious being. Everyone will equally say that, you know. And so here we have, we have an agreement. I am, I exist, I am a conscious being. But then it doesn't stop there. What makes the aham, the I, an ahankara, is that the I then lassoes, you know, it takes to itself the things that are actually objects of experience, objects of perception. So, for instance, if I use words to label my being as I am, I just say I am an existent being. Then I ask, can you show me that existent being? What does the existent being look like? What does the existent being that I am look like? And then I'll say, well, it looks like me. This body, this mind, this sense organs, this person here is what I look like, you know? And so it's just like that. So the amness, the being that I am, the conscious being that I am, is immediately defined by what I call an upadhi. An upadhi is a technical term. It means anything in my experience, anything that is in fact objectifiable to me, but which is easily identified as me. In other words, take for example, this physical body is known to you only through your five sense organs. Right? If you were to remove the five sense organs one by one, like if you remove your eyes, you can't see this body. If you remove your ears, you can't hear the body. If you remove your sense of smell, you can't smell the body. Nor can you smell the rest of the world, but you also don't have contact with the body. I think if you remove your sense of touch, you also can't feel the body. Right? So you can't see the body, you can't hear the body, you can't feel the body, you can't smell the body, all five, so you can't taste the body. All five sense organs that are not functioning, when they're not functioning, where is the physical body for you? Then if you say, I am, I exist, that is not going to be superimposed upon something which you have no perception of. You see what I mean? I can't superimpose my being on something which is not there to carry that superimposition. And so as long as I have the five sense organs functioning, this body, which is really known to me through the five sense organs, becomes something which I can identify with as me. It's the same with the sense organs. As long as I have these sense organs, like I can say to you, I am seeing, I am seeing. That's an identification with the sense organs. If my eyes don't work, I can't say, I am seeing. I'll say, I am. But that am won't attach onto something which is non-functional. I may say, I used to be able to see and now I'm blind. I used to be able to hear and now I can't hear, I'm deaf. You see what I mean? And so the objects, these objects of experience and the objects that the sense organs which are capable of experiencing, the sense organs themselves are both experiencer and experiencing. Like for instance, I'm aware of my eyes and I'm aware of what my eyes see. They become an instrument of seeing. But I actually objectify the eyes so that I can tell you, my eyes work. I have 20/20 vision. I'm aware of that. And then I can also tell you about what my eyes see. See what I mean? Now, if I tell you, I am the eyes, which I am aware of, which see, then I am identifying my being with something that I objectify and something which I perceive. That identification is what we call the ahankara. I am creating an I. I am giving myself to this, making this me. So I'm making an I. That's what the ahammati is, what the ahankara is. It's the same with my mind, with the thoughts in my mind. I say, I can either say, I am my mind, or I can say, I am happy, or I am sad, or I am thinking. All of the gunas, all of the qualities of the mind, I can identify myself with. even though those thoughts and emotions or feelings are something which are objectified to me and are coming and going. But that isn't something that I think about. I automatically will identify with that thought or that mood or that emotion as myself. And so now what happens is the I am becomes sad. The I am becomes happy or agitated, or in reference to the body, you know, tired or energetic or thin or fat or young or old. Whatever this whatever qualities belong to the body, I can say, well, I am, just speaking philosophically, I'll say, well, I believe I am this body, and when this body dies, I die. Otherwise, you don't go around saying you're the body. You don't walk around saying, well, I am this body. That's a philosophical statement normally. But you will say, I am tall or short or fat or thin or tired or healthy or sick. All of these are qualities that belong to the body or to the pranas that enliven the body. Identify with that. That act of identification is what we call the ahankara, that the I taking on these qualities of my experience. Now, say if the I, right, the I is just a word, but this word I is first and foremost for all of us just labeling the conscious being that I am. Right? Because this conscious being that I am, the me, is sometimes happy, sometimes sad, sometimes thin, sometimes fat, sometimes healthy, sometimes, you know, sometimes healthy, sometimes whatever condition happens to be there, or whatever condition the mind is in, whatever condition the sense organs are in, whatever role of life I happen to be in, whatever relationship I happen to be in, I am that. Means the identity that I am is remaining there as the constant, and the objects of experience that I'm continually identifying with are changing, 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 changing. That doesn't bother me because I am always present to whatever that condition is, and if I have a name for it, then that's fine. I am, and in relationship to you, I'm teacher, you're a student. In relationship to my mother, I'm daughter. My mother is mother. Right? It's all relational. But it's still me. You don't have any doubt about that. You are the one who, in the relational role, is the mother, daughter, father, you know, or child, or whatever the relational role is. You are that, you know. What we do, and that's true. It is true. There's not somebody else is that. So, but the problem is that we don't realize is that I am the constant. And all of these roles and all of these conditions go on changing, 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 changing. I just happen to be the being, you know, which is the constant in all of those roles. I'm not changing at all. I am the self of all of those roles. And so when that is the case, you know, which I mean, it is actually obviously the case once it's pointed out. Right? What would happen if the I, the self, the I am me, or whatever, instead of identifying with the changing roles that are coming and going, you know, and totally relative, that this I identified with the constant, the one who is present to all of the varying conditions. That's the state of knowledge versus ignorance, really. The ahankara, or the I-mati, the aham-mati, is a product of what we call ajnanam. It's a product of self-ignorance that causes what we call a superimposition. It causes what we call, in Sanskrit, just so that you hear these Sanskrit terms, what we call anyonya adyasa. It brings about, because of that ignorance, that non-differentiation of my own presence, the constancy of my own presence, what happens is I take myself to be one with the intimate experiences that I'm having. You know, and I say, you know, one of the main culprits is the sense of touch. The sense of touch goes through your entire body, you know, and it doesn't extend. Look at how your eyes, they extend out to embrace the room. Your sense of hearing extends out to embrace the room, right? even your sense of smell extends out to the room. But your sense of touch runs through the entire body. It's still a sense organ, but it runs through the entire body. And it will only feel what the body touches. Right? The sense of touch runs through the whole body, and then the body feels, you know, whatever it touches. And so that gives you a real sense of what we call Dehatma Buddhi, where there's a conviction that I am this body, because my sense of touch doesn't go out and extend into the whole room to make me this. My sense of touch only extends here. And so even though your sense of touch and your use of the sense of touch is something that's coming and going, because you're not always focused on your body. Sometimes you're reading, sometimes you're in a conversation, sometimes you're watching a movie where there's no focus on the sense of touch. You know? And so there's not always this ahankara, this anyonya adyasa that's taking place, that's born of ignorance. But let's look at it for a minute. If that superimposition, even though this physical body is an object of my sense, five sense organs, that's how I know it, which is true. But with that being true, what is the experience? The experience is that this body, even though it is perceived by me, we don't think about that, this body is a conscious being, is conscious, is me. This body is me, which means this body gains the conscious being, and then what do I gain? If I am this body, I gain being mortal and being different from you. Right? I am this physical body. This physical body enjoys consciousness. It enjoys me. So it has me-ness, which is fine. It becomes me. And but then what do I become? I become someone who is subject to death and limited and different from you, means the ahammati, the I thought, the jiva, is different from the jagat, the world, because the sense of I doesn't go out here, you know. And then I'm also different from Ishwara. That is the situation, all brought about by this identification with the experiences that I actually perceive. It's an identification with experiences, without exception, of experiences which come and go. Even though I remain and the experiences come and go, all of those experiences, when they are there, enjoy me. And so the mind, which is itself illumined, which is the self that's suffering from bondage, right? Atma, the consciousness not suffering from bondage. The mind that's always illumined, always enjoying consciousness, what is it going to say? It's going to say, I'm the conscious being. And it is the conscious being. It's true. The mind says, I am me. And then it also goes on to say, and this me that I am, the mind talking, this me that I am, this me is this body. Without this body, I think the mind, I the mind, will die. And so I the mind am a product of this body. I the conscious mind am a product of this body. Even though the physical, the body is known through the five sense organs, right? And the mind itself, every thought modification that you have comes into being and goes out of being, comes into being and goes out of being. And every one of them equally enjoys me, which is not coming into being and going out of being. And so this is the problem born of what we say lack of viveka. There's a lack of discrimination. Right? And why would the mind think to discriminate? Why would it think to discriminate whenever the mind is, consciousness is? You know, it says, whenever I am, there is consciousness. Therefore, I'm the conscious being. But Vedanta has to come on along and say, that is true. Whenever you are, consciousness is. But when you're not, consciousness still is. Right? That is the satyam mitya. When you say it, look, think of it like this. When the thought is, when your thought is, any thought, any given thought, when that thought is, consciousness is. When that thought is gone, consciousness still is. But all you're saying, all the mind is saying, is that whenever my I am, whenever this, and really look at the mind is thought, emotion, it's a flow. Right? So whenever this thought is, I am. And the mind says, yeah, I am never without consciousness. Okay? That's its perception, because every thought enjoys consciousness, but every thought comes and goes and the consciousness remains. That is the satyam mitya. That means, satyam mitya means that what is real doesn't come and go. What is dependent on that reality, but comes into being and goes out of being, that's what we call mitya. It's a dependent reality. So in my whole experience, I remain as the constant and everything else comes and goes. There's no viveka there until there is. That viveka is what knowledge is all about. So, Ramana, his main teaching methodology is to analyze the nature of this ahankara. So what he says, at first he says, you know, every school of thought within the Vedic tradition, you know, begins with this naming of who is the jiva, the I, the individual, who is this world, and who is Ishvara. This is Ishvara, this is the world, this is the individual. This is where it starts. As long as the ahankara is there, these three are there. But then, so idam trayam yavat aham matihi shat. Yavat means as long as. As long as the I thought is there, then these three, jiva, jagat, ishwara, all three of them are there. But then he says, sarvottama, sarva uttama, aham mati shunya nishta. Better than all of that, the most exalted of that, but the most exalted nishta. This word nishta, nishta means a commitment, a knowledge, a conclusion, an irrevocable conclusion is a nishta, where you are devoted to a particular recognition, where you have a firm recognition. So he says, the ahammati shunya nishta. What is better or best among all of these mattas? What is the best position to take? Right? Is that nishta where there is no ahankara? What remains? What is there if the ahankara is not there? That is the reality. So, and that state of understanding is sarva uttama. That is the most exalted, because that really is the state of jnanam or moksha or freedom. Because with the shunya means the absence, you know, the negation of the I thought, what you have is Ishvara. What you have is the whole. If you negate the I thought, what you have is the whole. So let me just speak to that for a minute. There is a difference between you, your own presence, and a thought in the mind that we call the ahankara or the aham that says I. There is a difference between you and the I thought. Just like there is a difference between this lamp and a label lamp. Right? So this is what we call the padartha. This is the meaning of the word. This is the thing. The word lamp is just a word that's referring to this thing, right? If I don't use the word lamp, the lamp is still there, right? I don't need the word lamp for the lamp to be there. The lamp is a word that points to this object, right? You see what I mean? You don't need it. You don't have to say lamp and then lamp appears. Lamp is a word that's a descriptor of an object. It's the same for you. When you say I or I am, it's not the I am word that makes you. It's not creating you. It's a descriptor. It's a word. It's what we call an abhidhana. Abhidhana means it's just a label. You know, everything, this is a chair. This is a, it's a label. Chair is not this. It's a label for this. And so when you say, I am, right, those words are not you. They are describing, they are a word, abhidhana. They are a label for you, right? Now, if the words I am are misinformed, you know, if they are based in ajnanam or based in ignorance, then what would that mean? Because it's not going to be that ajnanam or ignorance is totally covering your presence. Because if the ignorance was totally covering your presence, there's no word that's going to be available because there's no experience there. Like, for instance, you know, if you're walking along at night or in the dusk and you happen to see something on the side that looks like a snake, you know, you see something there and you react, it's only a rope, but actually you've seen that thing, but you haven't seen the ropeness of it, then you can react to it as a snake. You can mistake that rope for a snake. And then you get this whole medley of problems based upon the snake, which you've perceived, which was really only a rope. But you have a whole medley of problems based upon the snake. You understand? Now, what if you're and your friend are walking along at dusk, and that rope is there by the side of the path, but neither one of you see it? The ajnanam, the ignorance, is total. Okay? The rope ignorance is total. And so there's no problem. There's nobody there to react to the snake. And so what you're having there in that problematic ignorance, that's why Swamiji will joke and say, you know, total ignorance is bliss. There's no problem at all. Because there's nobody there making a mistake off of the ignorance. And so, for instance, when you go into deep sleep and the ahankara, the I notion, the mind is in totally resolved into its own causal condition, there's no problem because there's no awake mind to be making a mistake upon its misconception. And so here, like that, if somebody walks along, they don't see the rope at all, so there's no projection of a snake. So similarly for you, for your mind, if your mind's in deep sleep, the situation, your presence is still there, but there's nobody commenting on it one way or another. No problem. Ignorance is bliss. But now say the mind is awake. And now this awake mind, you know, has the experience of me. It has the, I'm not, you know, the mind is awake. And so it will say, it's now able to label things. And so it's going to label me. How is it going to label me? Half of it will be correct. I am, I exist, I'm a conscious being. These are just words that we use. I am me. If you say, you know, I am me, I'm a self, I'm a person. All of these things, these words that are all applying to yourself as a conscious being. You know, it's awake to that and it's a proper description. But because I don't know what this me is, it is not only my self-experience, it's my self-experience plus the ignorance of not knowing who I am. It's kind of like if you see the rope, but you don't see it as rope, you still have an experience of the rope in terms of its three bends, and it's got three bends, and it's like an inch and a half in diameter. You perfectly have that experience. But you see it as a snake. And then you react to the snake. Right? But the snake is the three bends, and it's the inch and a half in diameter. Right? That's exactly the same position, everything is there. So here, you, the one who is actually changeless and not taking on any of the conditions that are coming and going, you know, are taken by the mind, not by consciousness. You always remain exactly the same. You're just me, your own presence, the I that is never coming and going in any way. But the mind, because of ignorance, knows you and doesn't know you. It has the general recognition of you, just like I have the general recognition of the rope, but I miss the ropeness, and so I can project the snake on it. I have the general recognition, the mind, when it says, I am the conscious being, that's because, just like the snake has no being other than the rope, the mind has no being other than me. But then the mind says, the mind talking now, it says, I am me. I am me. I am the self. I am the conscious being. Well, why shouldn't it say that? You know, it's like the snake saying, I am the one who has three bends. I am the one who am an inch and a half. It's how I say, the mind says, I am the conscious being. You know? So what has to happen there? You know, what has to happen is that this mind, it's not enough to tell the mind, you know, well, let me use the rope snake example for a minute. In order for, say when we tell the story like this, the two boys are walking along at the dusk, and one mistakes a snake for a rope snake, and reacts to that, and feels he's been bitten because he rubbed up against it, and goes through all this emotional trauma, you know, because of that. Now, to relieve that boy of the emotional trauma, it's not enough to just say that wasn't a snake. He has to see the rope, right? Like if I were to say to you, you're not your mind, you're not your body, you know, you're not your happiness and sorrow and agitation, you are not these things. I can negate and negate and negate. It means nothing. Until I recognize what we call the adhishtana, the thing that is actually there. And that is what has to happen here. You know, that boy has to be able to see that the three bends that he thought were the snake are the rope. And we have to see that the consciousness that gets the label of me, of I, is not the mind. That the mind is actually, that the conscious being that I am is actually the one that illumines the mind, that has a subject-object relationship with the mind, that is there as the constant when the thoughts come and go. These are all what we call prakriyas. I have to be able to see that. I have to recognize it. Oh, I remain as the thoughts come and go. Right? There's a subject-object relationship that I myself am never changing to be able to call myself a thought. Or I myself am never never going through any type of experiences come and go, every type of experience, but I remain as the constant. I have to be able to make that differentiation. That's what we call knowledge. When that's so, the ahankara now is no longer ahankara because the mistake is not there. We call it a dugda bija. It's a seed. Like for me, I might say I'm walking to the store, but all of a sudden my atma, myself, hasn't become this physical body to walk to the store. Right? The aham now lands on what it actually is. That's what we mean by knowledge. But if the aham, the word aham, lands now on just me, the conscious being, and there's no more false, you know, creation of me by identifying with something that's actually an experience that comes and goes, then what am I in relationship to this room? See, in this room right now, there's subject-object relationship, right? I see you. I am the subject, I am the jiva, and you are all the jagat. You know? And Ishwara is out there somewhere. So jiva, jagat. But what if the ahankara, is no longer, the aham is no longer identified with any of the objectified experiences that come and go, That means then that the me, the conscious me, is no longer just identified with this body, this mind, the sense organs, or with anything, in fact. And so then what happens is, just think about this for a minute. If just in reference to your own, to your perception of this room, you have to look at your experience a little bit differently. There has to be a shift in the way that you see, that you actually are cognizing this experience. And the shift goes like this. If I were to say right now, that painting is 10 feet from me, or 12 feet from me. That painting there is 12 feet from me. And what am I saying? That the painting is 12 feet from my body. That's true. But I didn't say that the painting is 12 feet from my body. I said the painting is 12 feet from me. Right? So you didn't even think about it. The painting is 12 feet from me. No, painting is 12 feet from my body. What if I were to say, how far away is that painting from my awareness? How far is it away from my awareness? It's in my awareness. It's not far from my awareness. It's in my awareness. I said, well, how far is the painting, how far is that cedar chest from me? I can either say it's 8 feet from me, you know, if the me is this body, but if the me is the awareful being, then how far away is it from my awareness? Then it's not away from my awareness. It's in my awareness. Then how far is this body from my awareness? This body is in my awareness. Okay? There's no distance between my awareness and my body. No distance between my sense organs and my body. No distance between my mind and my body. No distance between any experience and my body. And so, in fact, what you can say, like say you get rid of this ahankara, you can say that this entire experience of everything objectified, everything known, which includes the body, the mind, the sense organs, the eye thought, all the knowledges and things that are floating through the mind, all of the perceptions, all of them are equally in my awareness. There's no distance. It's not like more awareness is on this side and less on this side. It's whatever falls within my field of perception, which includes the body, mind, sense organs, all of it is in my awareness. So now the question is, if you see it like that, then you can say all of this is in me. Say if I say all of this is in me, or I can say I pervade, this is just language, all of this is in me, I pervade all of this, none of this is away from me. This is all types of language we try to use when we're teaching. There's some hoping that some of it will work. Now you say, all of this is me, I pervade this whole thing. Then what if I ask you, well, where am I located? Where am I? Where is my being? In this, we're just not talking about the universe now, we're just talking about this room. Where is me? Where's the me? If you bring the ahankara in, the me is here. Because the ahankara means it identifies with the body, mind, sense organs. If you don't bring the ahankara in, then where is the I located? And that's an interesting meditation, because from your standpoint as a conscious being, just as consciousness, you're not big or small. Space itself, the space and time and air, fire, water, earth, and all the elementals, all of those things exist within a dimension. Your being is not dimensional. Consciousness isn't big or small. But there's nothing away from it. Let me just give you an example so you see what I mean. what we're doing right now in reference to the room and seeing that, gee, my, without the ahankara, myself is the room. I mean, the room exists in me. I am its being. That's harder for me to really deeply appreciate than if I were to say, when I say, think of a meadow, a beautiful meadow with trees and, you know, animals and sun and stars, just imagine a meadow. And put people in the meadow and put yourself in the meadow as a jiva, as an individual in this form. Put yourself in the meadow with people. You just imagine that meadow. Right? Now when you do that, your mind is imagining a meadow. It's easy for you to say, since it's your imagination, it's easy for you to say, I pervade that whole meadow. The me that I am is the self of the whole meadow. Do you see that? It's not, I don't think that's hard. That's something that we can easily do. I can say, I'm the self of the whole meadow. And now if you put yourself in the meadow, in this form, like if you have a dream and you're in the dream, now have in the meadow, you're in the meadow, that, and you say, now, from the standpoint of me, the one who imagines the meadow, and I say, I am the self of the whole meadow, that's easy. But now, for yourself as an individual within the meadow, for you to say, you can easily say, as the one in the meadow, I am a conscious being. This body, mind, sense organs that is, you know, experiencing the meadow, I am the conscious being. Mm-hmm. That's what we say here. I am the conscious being who's experiencing this room. So say you have your meadow imagination and your character in the meadow. You say, I'm the conscious being who's experiencing this meadow. See, think what it takes for this conscious being, the person in the meadow, you've entered the meadow in your imagination. See what it takes for that person to recognize that, in fact, I am the self of the whole meadow. For that character in the meadow to be able to recognize that, the ahankara has to go from the identification with the body, mind, sense organs character in the meadow to the consciousness itself, which is then released from the meadow and becomes the self of the meadow. See that once if the ahankara releases itself from the body, mind, sense organs person in the meadow, then the I is still there, the me is still there, but it no longer belongs, it's no longer taken to be or limited by the individual in the meadow. And so that's what, when the individual realizes that, what does it take for that individual to realize that? It has to realize that everything about its experience as a jiva, the body, the mind, the sense organs, the thoughts, even the ahankara, all of it are objectifiable and part and parcel of the whole panorama of the meadow. It comes with the meadow, it belongs to the meadow. It's part and parcel of the meadow. And the self which it enjoys is the self which is free. The self which is free, from which the whole meadow comes, and which the whole meadow goes away, and what's left, is the self, the me, which is free of time and space. It outlasts time and space. And so it's very, very helpful to play with the meadow in your mind, or the ocean, or whatever you like to imagine. To recognize, to try to pinpoint this experience, the recognition of this experience. When you have an imagination, the entire, in the imagination there's always, because there's dimension in imagination, there's time and space, right? And there's dimension. It's, what do you call it? Three-dimensional. An imagination is three-dimensional. Like this room is three-dimensional. Yourself, your own self experience, it's not three-dimensional. It's not dimensional. Because there's no parts to it. It's not, there's no extension. There's just conscious being. And the conscious being is not located anywhere. It's just that within the time and space manifestation, like this room or like the meadow, there is no possibility of any imagination extending beyond your being. So now, imagine it. Say if I ask you, imagine a universe. Whatever your conception of a universe is, you just imagine it. Boom, you imagine it. There it is. That imagination, it's absolutely impossible for it to extend beyond conscious being. Well, that can happen. So that dimensional imagination takes place within conscious being, which is totally homogeneous. By homogeneous means it is only one thing. It is only one non-dual thing. And so now, if you understand that, you can play with that experience by just using your imagination and recognizing that it is your non-dual, non-dimensional presence which is the self of the dimensional imagination. It is exactly the same here. Your being is not on the right side and the left side, up and down. It is only non-dual me. But that no amount of dimensional imagination or the entire universe can be away from that non-dual presence, because there nothing exists except it. Time and space are belong to this creation, and the creation is continually changing. It's mitya. It has no being of its own. But a being that is free, the me that is free of time and space, this my own presence, you know, is going to be the full and complete self that has no extension at all, but all extension cannot be away from it. And so if this sounds like gibberish, it can sound like gibberish, but the way to make it not sound like gibberish is that the words are actually pointing to a reality which you have to recognize. And that is the reality of your own changeless presence in reference to all of this that comes in, these experiences that come and go, that include the body and the mind, the sense organs and everything. And so here, what Ramana is saying is that it is this recognition that there is nothing here but me, and nothing can touch me or change me in any way. Just like the whole imagination of a meadow, I am the whole. I am unchanged by the whole. There is nothing here but me. That is the Sarvottama. Sarvottama means that is the most exalted state. That is the truth. That's what he means. It. That is the truth. It is that nishtha, that recognition, that firm understanding, which is the ahamati shunya, which is devoid of this ahankara. It's not devoid of me. It's devoid of this manufactured me, this false me, that's the me that's superimposed on these things that it is not. Just think about it. When you have a dream and you're in the dream and it's so very real, and you're a character in the dream, and then the alarm goes off and that whole dream just goes, the whole thing goes. And whoever you were in the dream, gone. But nothing has happened to you at all. In fact, nothing has happened. This is a major thing, Michelle. It's not only that nothing has happened to you, there's nothing has happened. And the whole dream is gone. Nothing has happened. That's what we're faced, that's what the situation is here. And so, it is very joyous, in a sense, to recognize that which is most dear, which is you, because if you're not here, what pleasure is there? Mm-hmm. See what I mean? All the sukha and dukkha, all the joys and sorrows, all of the accomplishments, all of the things that we want to have and want to enjoy and all of this, who cares about it if I'm not here? You know, all of these things, all of the experiences we have really are, is in one verse, you say like this, all of the experiences that we have are gifts coming to us through the sense organs, you know, all bowing down, you know, they're all in honoring us, the self. All the experiences that are, they're like flowers being given to the self continually. You know. Nothing is happening to the self. All of these things, all of this, it's all just coming and going. There's nothing here except for me. And so its presence and absence, in fact, doesn't affect me in any way. That's what we need to recognize, that the one who is not affected, that me, you know, the one that I want to know, do I, is there anything about me that doesn't die? I really don't want to die. You know, it's fine for all of the negative things to go away and all of the experiences. I don't mind changing the experiences. I don't mind getting rid of all of the sukha and dukkha. But could I remain? That I is, that self is the beloved. That one, the one that is you, is the beloved. You know, the one that is most dear is only your own being. And the joy is when you recognize that that being that you are is the being. That is the self of Ishwara. That's the self of the whole creation. That's the truth of the whole thing. And so here, how Ramana is saying, that is the reality. Just get rid of this ahankara, this false thing, this superimposition brought about by just non-recognition of your own self. If you get rid of this improper naming, you know, then you are the whole. And that is moksha. That is liberation. Just all of the religions include, and all of the darshanas, including Advaita Vedanta, they begin with the reality that we find ourselves in. All of them do. We find, here I am. Here this universe is. Here is God, whatever God is. That's where we start. But for Advaita Vedanta, for the Upanishad, that's certainly not where it ends. You have to start with where the person is. You start with what the person is. You start with the ajnanam, and then you remove it. And when you remove it, this whole idea of jiva, jagat, ishwara goes away to their one ishwara. You can say like that. There is one ishwara. There's one self, which is my being, and the whole manifestation of this infinite creation that this being enjoys. You can say like that, so then I am Ishwara. Or you can say, just say, I am Brahman. I am the self. It's like saying, I am the clay, or I am the clay pot. You know? I can say, and both are true. You know, I am the clay, I am the clay pot. In the sense that I can say, this whole creation is me. I am Ishwara. Or I can just say, I am the consciousness, which is the truth of this whole creation. Both are true. Do you understand what I mean? Like if I say, I am Brahman, or I am Ishwara, you're saying exactly the same thing, because Brahman is Ishwara. Ishwara has no being from away from Brahman. And so in the end, that's the sarvabhauma. You remove the ahankara, and that's what you're left with. Of course, there's a lot of teaching to make you understand that's what you're left with. But in fact, that is what you're left with. Okay, I'm going to stop there. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Why is it that when you use these words, the most beloved, and I am dear to myself, it resonates with me, but when these words like consciousness and awareness, they don't have the same emphasis.
I know, and I think words like all of the words, existence, consciousness, awareness, they have an abstract quality to them. Mm-hmm. And so, just like, you know, you can abstract like space. If you think of awareness, it's kind of like space. Like, who wants to be awareness? It's
an object.
Yeah. There's something abstract about it, you know. But we have to keep using different words, like awareness, consciousness, existence, but then being, my being, amness, me. All of these words that are pointers, they're just being used to point to myself. You know, and so you have to keep playing and massaging those words to get rid of the kind of the relative meaning of the word, the conceptual meaning of the word that everybody has. See, we're using language to point to something. That's the problem. Why it can work and why this teaching methodology works is because the language that we're using, even though it's inappropriate, really, because all of the language that we have is only meant to label things within duality. But because the reality of what they're pointing to is present, and it is you, those words can point the mind to that recognition. But in the end, it's the nature of yourself that's going to define the words that have been used as pointers. Right? Because... Hi, Tibby. The words here, like I can say, like if I'm teaching, I can say, now this is what we call a book. You know, and so your eyes land on this, and then we give a word for it. You understand what I mean? But here, for the self, you know, you can say the body, the mind can land with the word self, the words can land on the body. It can even land on the mind. These are all objectifiable things. But consciousness, my own being, is not an object that I can hold up and say, now you know, this is what we call the self. You can't do that. However, the non-objectifiable me that you are is present. And so there's no reason why, and it is the very being of the mind that illumines the mind, there's no reason at all that words can't be handled in such a way to point you to the recognition of that reality. It would be very different if the self was somewhere out there beyond your experience. But it actually is the very core of your experience. It's just not an experience that's subject-object, objectifiable, as something that you can see through your sense experience, sense perception. But it's not that you aren't your own self experience. You're the ground of all experience. In fact, your being is the very center of all experience. It's self evident, we say. You know, when you're meditating, for instance, and you're withdrawing your mind and relaxing your body, so basically, so it'll disappear from your perception. So you just make it as relaxed as possible, so that it's not in the way, in any way.
Yeah, and dimension goes away too.
Yeah, and then you're, you know, doing breathing exercises and maybe repetition of a mantra or something to make the mind become very quiet so it disappears. You know, getting rid of all of the objects of experience in a subject-object. You're getting rid of all of the objects of experience, leaving just your self-shining presence. You're not leaving your presence, which then you need to bring in another presence to objectify. It's that your presence is self-evident, self-effulgent. You know, and those in Sanskrit, that's the words they use. It's swaprakasha. Swaprakasha means it's self-effulgent. Swatasiddha means it's self-evident. Self-evident means self-shining. It doesn't need another means of knowledge to come in and shine on it to make it known. It is itself consciousness. is self-evident, doesn't need anything. Get rid of the whole creation, the whole Maya, like get rid of the dream, get rid of the whole projection of duality, and conscious being that you are, this me, your own presence, is what remains. This, your self-evident me, that is just infinite, infinite, not spatially infinite. It has nothing to do with space. Time and space comes with the creation. Infinite in that there's nothing else. Once there's nothing else, there's no boundaries to say, you know, there's 2 10-miles or 1,000,000 miles. Then there has to be a right side and a left side. What if when there's nothing else? So that those words can be very abstract and intellectual. But those words have to land on your own self-experience. Like, for instance, when you're contemplating, for instance, and you ask yourself, let the mind ask as your mind becomes quiet, let the mind ask you something like, what color am I? How big am I? How wide am I? You know, how tall am I? All of these words are totally irrelevant. They have no place, you know. And so it's not that you're a big me or a little me. No place, because there's nothing else. So that's why your own presence, your own me, the me that is present to all of your experience, is the me that's present to the universe. It's not that Ishwara has a big me and you have a little me. There's no big and little. It's that the me that you are is the me of the universe. It's not that Ishwara has a bigger me than you do. It's that the me that you are is the me, is the same. And that to really understand that beyond those words have to work as pointers to your experience. That's why, you know, you have to like practice in a sense. And you notice it in your contemplation. Notice it right now. Notice it in imagination. Watch your thoughts coming and going. And notice that nothing happens to you. You can play with that in all different kinds of ways because it's true in every single experience. So you might as well bring in experience from all different angles, all different types of experience, you know, and changing of experience, changing of thoughts, changing of location, all of this type of thing, you know, to just recognize, that's what we call viveka, to recognize that nothing ever touches or happens to your self in any way. Look at it in terms of consider having, you know, when you have these negative experiences or you're depressed or sad or all of these things that we go through. See if you're still there. You see, nothing has happened. This experience, these experiences are negative experiences, and it's not that they're not hurtful experiences. By nature, that's what they are, right? But you are there. And there's a difference between you and the passing experience, whether it be a positive one or a negative one. And that's the viveka. Viveka means that to be able to discriminate that. And then you'll see, you know, when you experience this room, just through your sense organs, where are you in the room, your being? You can't really locate it, but in a way you can't locate it. You can't say, oh, it's in the chair or it's on the table. But of course it is. But it's not only there. So say you can, just for almost like an upasana or just like a meditation, you can say, okay, I'm right in the middle of the room. My presence is right in the middle of the room. Because you are the center of all experience. And so you can kind of pretend like in this room, there's a center point in the room. So put your, just imagine your presence, the me, right in the center of the room. Just your own presence right in the center of the room. The useful thing about that, I mean, it's not any more in the center of the room than it is in the side of the room. From the standpoint of the self, there's no right side or left side. But the nice thing about doing that, just seeing your own me, your own self right in the center of the room, not this body or mind or sense, or even just me, is that it kind of breaks through that dehatma buddhi, mm-hmm. that conviction, that false identification of your own presence belonging to or being contained in this body, mind, sense organs. It's not contained in anything. It's not contained. It's always exactly the same. In fact, it's the very substance of the entire, you are the very substance of the entire creation. And that's recognizable. It's just that this identification with the body, mind, sense organs is so strong.
So you're saying that you're not talking about the body or the mind. You're saying you're talking about something different.
I'm talking about me, my own self. And when you say my, of course.
Well, that's body.
Yeah, but I'm not using it that way. I'm dumped the my and all these just into the self that you are. See, when we use a word like my, okay, then my brings in like my body or myself as different from yourself, mm-hmm. myself. Mm-hmm. So that's the problem with it. But when we're talking about me, each one of us in this teaching, each one of us is talking about the self that I am. And so I have to recognize the self that I am in reference to this body, mind, sense organs. And so saying this myself is very natural because it's always being said in reference to the body, the mind, or the sense organs. You know, but in the end, the my goes away. But the me remains. So when you use my and me are two important words to de-abstract the word self. Because when you say me, that's not abstract. And so for what has to happen is that an abstract word like consciousness or existence or awareness, these are very abstract words, they have to resolve into the word me. So that when you say awareness, you might as well be saying me. See what I mean? When you say consciousness or existence, you're talking about me. So if you're saying existence, and to you that means something other than the very personal me that you are, then you haven't know what existence means. So you can see how tricky all of these words, mm-hmm. we're always unpacking these words and pointing, because otherwise the words are stuck, are only landing on the objects that they were meant for. Because all of the words that we have are words that are defining objects within duality. And we have to use those words to point to, you know, that which is the self of duality, the being of duality, but not an object within duality. So, you know, it's an art. Teaching Vedanta is an art, and the master of this art is Swamiji. He's the master. He's like a Picasso or something. Because he thinks about it like that too. He really thinks about it. Every word that he uses and he keeps, it's like, you know, if like a painter is using these colors, he thinks, I'm not going to use this color anymore. It's really getting the right, not the right feeling. But he does that with words. This word is bringing up other concepts that I don't want it to bring. I'm not going to use this word anymore. And he'll have something that he's been saying in a particular way. He said, the saying it quite in this way isn't working. Let me try this way. You know?
I'm going to ask about Vairagya. You know, I've heard you say that when we say Vairagya, you know, it's not this. And yet, at the same time, I can appreciate that because it's so easy for that old orientation to take over. You know, so you can see it coming. And as soon as you give the mind sort of an inch to get involved, it just you know, and there has to be some initial orientation. It seems like where you just keep pulling it back, which is sort of like this, like, no, I'm not going to go there at all, because it's such a slippery slope.
You know, when they say that it's not like this, what they mean is that we have what we call raga and dvesha, you know? And so raga is that going toward. Dvesha is going away from. But both of them are done so that I can be happy. I go toward things so I can be happy. I go away from things so I can be happy. And so we think of vairagya like this. All of you stay away from me. You know, keep away. Don't let these things, these things that used to be a temptation for me, keep them away, you know. And in the end, you can use that for some sort of a discipline in order to break an attachment to a given thing. You know, if that's all, that's all right. But as long as you know what you're doing, you know, we can use these type of techniques and things to stay away from something that is causing you pain. There's an addiction to it in some sort of a way, or you know, you have a concept toward that thing that is continually reoccurring, and so you say, might say, I'm just going to keep away from that for a while. But what if you say, that, no. That's not where you want to end up. You want to end up where the thing is fine the way it is. It does not take away from your well-being. You know, it's like in the Ramakrishna, Swamiji actually makes fun of this. He doesn't make fun of the person. He makes fun of the disciples who think they're telling something really good about Ramakrishna. You know, just being foolish. And this is the story. They say that this one disciple wanted to test Ramakrishna's vairagya. And so what they did was take a gold coin and put it under his mattress, yeah, to see what would happen, thinking that certainly the putting the gold coin under his mattress, he wouldn't be able to sleep. Doesn't that make any sense to you? but the reason is that he has such an abhorrence toward gold that its presence would be disturbing for him. Even the very presence of wealth or riches would disturb him. And so the disciple wanted to test it out because he's very sensitive, you know. Ramakrishna's very sensitive. So he went and put some gold coin under his mattress, thinking that certainly he won't be able to sleep. He'll be very disturbed by the presence of that gold. You know? That's what they mean. He'll be very disturbed by that. And actually, if he had vairagya, it would be with the presence or absence of the gold, he's fine. Right? And so that's where you need to end up. Now, if you have to do some things in order to break some habits or stay away from certain situations just to get some distance on it so that you can have some objectivity, that's one thing, you know. But to kind of have to curtail your life because certain things are threatening to your well-being, that's another thing. And in fact, the whole Bhagavad Gita is kind of about that, where Krishna is telling Arjuna says, you know, I want to go away to the forest. So I take sannyasa and just be able to study. This is not good. Being here in the middle of all of this. Let me just go and be in the forest and live the life of a sannyasi. I can't do this here. And Krishna said, no, you do this here. When you can do this here, then you can go. And I think, you know, that's what it is. If you can be free here, you can be free there. But if you can't be free here, then when you're there, you're going to be taking the same problems with you, and those problems will get projected onto the nice foresty environment.
The question of involvement, though, the mind's involvement. So long as the mind stays really involved in everything that's happening, of course, there's a lot of reasons why being in the world, you continue to be involved. But so long as you have that kind of normal involvement in the environment and what's going on,
uh-huh.
It's really hard for that Dehabna Buddhi to not be constantly resurrected, even if you've seen something else, even if you've seen, I can't be.
Well, you can say that maybe for a while. And I'll take that what you're saying is that it would be nice to like be able to go to the ashram for 3 years and just immerse yourself in the study. But even so, say maybe you mean that. But in the end though, your total engagement in the world doesn't touch your knowledge at all, because yourself is not doing anything and is as immediately present, you know, as is all of the multi-level, multitasking engagement that you're engaged in. What causes a person to feel like they're getting lost in all of this activity is when there's really a lack of vairagya in reference to the activity, because then you lose your objectivity. You know, if you don't lose your, and by objectivity I don't mean kind of this kind of coldness. I don't mean that. I mean that your well-being is not at stake, and so you can be objective and deal in the world.
It's really just a question of how does that come about, that simultaneous involvement of the mind and the nishtha, you know.
It comes about through the recognition of your own presence amidst all of this. It's like recognizing yourself, the changeless one, amidst all of the changing. And then all of the different logic and the different unfoldments that keep making you to recognize from many different angles the truth of that, until there's no one, no nothing inside that is what we call a pratibandhaka or an obstruction to that recognition, including your emotions. You know, and once that's true, the emotions themselves are not really creating much havoc. The emotions create havoc to the degree that you want that something to be different. And that's the truth of it. And we're very layered in our wanting things to be different. It can start out just on the gross level, I want my house to be clean, or whatever it is. But then it can be, I want my mind to be like this, or I want my relationships to be like this, or I want to treat others like this and not that like that, or I want this and I want that. It goes into all kinds of very subtle realms of requirements. And whenever there's a real requirement, you know, that you have to be like this or I'm unhappy, that's the requirement. If it's that you're working on some quality, physical quality or emotional quality or mental quality, but you're working on it with love, like you would bring up a little child with love, and the child is blowing it here and there, then you're just helping, that's all. You know? But there's not this feeling like, oh, little child, you are a failure. You're a failed little child. You know? You're an inadequate little child. You don't think like that. You think, you know, let's try this way, let's do it that way. So you're trying to help, that's all. Then there's not that problem.
So if you're having a bad experience, where should your identity go? I mean, instead of getting grabbed?
It depends. You need a big toolkit. That's what I think. It's like say you're having a bad experience, and it's something that you can just dismiss. You know? And it's not an emotional bypass. It's just, oh, that's okay, and let's move on. It doesn't really cramp you or your knowledge. It's just a bad experience, and you can let it go. That's nice. That's all you do is let it go. if it's getting into really more deep kind of childhood hurts and things, then you have to be, then you have to give some space to that little part, little one inside. And that's where some learning how to really talk to yourself and be kind of kind to those parts inside is important, you know? And then there's the, then there's a different time where you're just getting caught. Your mind is getting pulled out and you're getting caught. And all you really need to do is bring it back. Bring your knowledge back. So it just depends on what kind of layer is in your psyche is getting, you know, caught and how you're going to deal with it. We do have hurts and complexes, and that those require a different kind of care. You know, to me, those that kind of care is like raising a little child, where it has, you know, love, and you have some love and understanding toward that part of yourself. And non-punishing, non-judgmental. the parts that have kind of been left behind and haven't had a chance to mature, you know, what do they need, really? What does a child need? It needs your love. It needs your respect. It needs to be liked. It needs to be the center of your attention. It means to, needs to be, you know, it needs to feel that it's important to you. This is what children need. These are what human beings need, but we all need that. We all need positive mirroring, you know, to think that somebody respects us and likes us and values us. But the little ones inside definitely need that. The whole structure builds up around that, you know. Love, like, and respect. Those are Swamiji's words. I like those words.
Yeah.
It's because they just, we all know what they mean. You know, and you need all three.
And we all want that.
Of course. And the only one that can give, the one that can give that to us the best is ourselves. Because other people aren't always accommodating. I can't tell the world, please, no, love, like, and respect me, and then I will survive. And Swamiji once told me, this one really meant so much to me. He said that you can never control what people give you in terms of whether they love you or like you or whatever it is. You can't control that. But you can control what you give. You can give love, you can like, you can respect. You can do that. You can't make other people do that, but you can do that to others. He wasn't talking about it. Inner child work is true also, but I mean, you can give that to others. And then he said, what he said is, in either way, whether it's coming this way or going that way, it's the same. You still get it. You see that?
Yeah.
Like, it's such a neat thing, really.
Yeah.
I mean, by the giving it, you're actually getting it. That same state is created, whoever it's coming from.
Because there is no difference.
Yeah, really. Yeah, it's just there.
Yeah.
And you can control it on your side, but you can't control it coming in. So don't bother with that. You just give it and everything is fine. And you can get that internally and externally. And I'm not trying to be idealistic. It's not that we're all doing that all of the time. Well, certainly I'm not doing that all of the time. But it's something I know about, and it's a value. You know, I know about this. And I'm really glad I know about this because it makes a difference. You know? Part of the, you know, like Swamiji wrote that book, Value of Values. You should all have that book. That's such a great book. Because that's what that book does, is make you understand why a given value is important. It's not, and like, say you just have a value, you know, thou shalt not steal. But then you might think, yeah, but if I did steal, if I did cheat on my taxes, you know, I would actually have a lot more money and that would make me happy. So you have to really understand why, what is the real use of a value? How does it help you? And then then you gain a value for the value, you know. And these little things that, you know, that we collect, like that I'm just sharing with you, that one particular one that Swamiji told me not that long ago, but I just realized it in a different way. It's so meaningful if you get it, you know. It becomes like one of the things that you know about, that helps in terms of settling down the mind. And they're all backed, all of those little things are backed by your knowledge, by your understanding of who you are.
Yeah.